30 years ago today, the world went on the air for the first time.
This is Marina Bauten in Moscow. For many, the main event of 96 will be the presidential elections in June.
Reporters told us what lies ahead, and you played the Geo Quiz.
Today's Geo Quiz might give you bad breath. Can you tell us where most of the world's supply of garlic comes from right now? We've been focused on climate change since the show began.
Representatives from some 150 countries have begun a conference in Geneva on global warming.
And of course, music has always been essential.
You can, like some people might call it world music, but in a sense, it's music that would never have happened without America. And so it's just one of those places where hyphenation is really a better strategy.
Stay with us as we look back on 30 years of the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Happy New Year to you and happy birthday to us. Today marks 30 years on the air for The World. To celebrate the milestone, we have a very special show for you, looking back at three decades of both our show and the wider world. This was day one.
This is The World. I'm Eddie Mayer in London with Tony Khan in Boston.
Tracer bullets and rocket-propelled grenades lit the sky last night over Sarajevo. Not an escalation of the war, but for the first time in 4 years in celebration of the peace.
January 1st, 1996, a different theme song, different hosts, but still with the top story of the day, the war in Bosnia. On that first broadcast, we also heard from our correspondent in Russia, when you could still have an independent journalist there.
This is Marina Bauten in Moscow. For many, the main event of 96 will be the presidential elections in June. Though neither Kremlin analysts nor our popular clairvoyants can predict who the next Russian leader will be.
Vladimir Putin was still the soft-spoken deputy mayor of St. Petersburg then, not on pundits' radars. But he was already starting his rise to power.
The World was and is a news show about things happening outside the U.S. And if you liked or didn't like what you heard, you'd write us letters. We gave out our snail mail address and phone number on air.
And had this hope for the future.
We'll also be connected pretty soon, our hope is, with the internet.
Now, I was not on the show back then in 1996, but you were, Marco. You were one of the founding members of the team. So I'm going to bow out here for a bit and let you lead us into the Wayback Machine.
3 decades on the air and counting, it is hard to believe, especially when I think about what has transpired in the world since 1996. When this show was greenlit, there was almost nothing like it on the air, a daily show for an American audience focused solely on international news. It remains unique. In the beginning, we were in partnership with the BBC World Service, and so rewind, let me bring in Neil Curry, someone who helped create the show. Neil, thank you so much for being part of the celebration.
It's my huge pleasure to be here with you, Marco.
So you were the show's first executive producer back in 1996. You were the man with the plan about what this hour of radio was going to be, ought to be. What was the vision you had for the world back then?
So the plan, there was not an entire void, but there was a gap in the market in a show that was not just dealing with the news as something, you know, when it hit the headlines, but how do you equip people to deal with those stories when they crop up? You know, if suddenly there's an earthquake in Indonesia or somewhere on the other side of the planet from the US, what context do you have to even understand, you know, what people are dealing with and how they're going to react to it? So the challenge for the world was to try and connect them to stories around the world, particular voices.
Music.
Basically, yeah, music, culture.
I mean, one of the things you really were critical in bringing was a whole range of voices from the ground.
Yeah. One of the things that was really critical was working with people who lived in those countries, who spoke the languages of those countries, and had the cultural context. And I think that was really borne out, particularly by people like Marina Bauten that we heard that clip from there. She was talking very much in terms of things that she knew about her own country.
Well, you mentioned Marina Bauten. There was also our reporter in South Africa.
I am Milton Nkosi reporting from Johannesburg. Each time I go to my mother's house in Soweto, I start by looking for tangible change, like tar on our roads, street lamps, and better living standards in general.
I mean, I've always felt very kind of passionately about this because we heard in that example with Milton was very much there talking in terms of his own experience. And I, personally, I feel that that is a way of really engaging an audience. One of the great things about The World was that it decided to go down this route. I mean, you'll remember we did research at the time because there was nervousness about, you know, accents and so on and so forth. But the research proved that it wasn't a question of an accent. It was a question of clarity, and that sort of diversity of accents was something that gave that kind of sense of a tapestry to The World, I think, that I personally felt made it even more attractive to have that diversity of voices and so on.
Neil, thanks for this, and please don't go away. It is fair to say that a turning point for our program and for the U.S. relationship with the rest of the globe more broadly was that deadly day, September 11th, 2001.
This is The World. I'm Lisa Mullins. Terrorists struck America's centers of government and finance today, and they hit their targets.
The building's exploding right now. You got people running up the street.
My colleague Matthew Bell joined the team here in Boston just around that time, and I want to bring him into the conversation. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, Marco.
So for a lot of people, especially in the U.S., 9/11 made the globe a lot smaller. It also brought foreign aggression to American soil. Those attacks opened up new front lines of war for the U.S., right?
Exactly. This sort of never-ending war on terror began right away. The official U.S. response to the 9/11 attacks really became clear in the hours and in the days that followed.
Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
Let's just walk through the timeline here, Marco. 1 week after September 11th, George W. Bush signed into law a resolution to use military force against those responsible for the 9/11 attacks. This really set the stage for the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan continued for 20 years. We sent reporters there over the years. We continued to report on that story. Of course, on top of that, this whole so-called war on terrorism was not just about Afghanistan. In the months after September 2001, we covered stories about the investigation into these terrorist attacks. You know, who was responsible? Who is this al-Qaeda group and Osama bin Laden? We covered stories about the prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, CIA black sites. We reported on the impact of new law enforcement policies on immigrant communities in the United States. So this was an absolutely enormous story for our program.
So, Matthew, you were thrown into the story and you covered it from many angles. You were also assigned to the Mideast as our correspondent there in Jerusalem for several years. And I'd love to hear how things looked for you from there and how your own work has dealt with all the angles to this news.
I think, like a lot of Americans, after 9/11, all of a sudden I had a lot to learn about a different part of the world. I mean, I went to the University of Vermont, studied Chinese history, went to journalism school, studied Chinese language. I was very focused on a different part of the world. And I did my first reporting trip to Jerusalem in 2006, and that turned into repeated reporting trips there, and then I got posted there for several years, was able to cover all kinds of stories in Israel and the Palestinian territories, and then in 2011, the Arab uprisings began, and that, again, that was another enormous story.
Really dramatic.
For us. And that played out over several years as well. You know, that was a big ongoing story for our program.
Matthew Bell, thank you very much for being with us for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Let's bring Shirin Jafari into the conversation. Shirin, you joined the program in 2015 as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were a boil. What are some of the stories that have stayed with you?
That's correct, Marco. I joined in 2015. And, you know, asking a reporter to choose between their stories is kind of like asking a parent to pick their favorite kid. But I'll
right.
give it a try. A lot of the reporting that I've done over the years that I've been with the show has focused on conflicts, you know, as you said, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Ukraine, and more recently in Gaza. And, you know, in every one of these wars, there's been one driving force for me and my reporting, and that is how the conflicts are impacting the lives of the people who are living through them, and how the decisions and policies that are being made in places like Washington and Moscow impacting the lives of people on the ground. And so let me tell you about one moment that will always stay with me.
Yeah, please.
So Let's go back to the summer of 2021. The U.S. has struck a deal with the Taliban, and it's getting ready to leave Afghanistan after about 2 decades of fighting. I'm in Kabul. The fighting is raging between Afghan forces and the Taliban. And in the middle of all this, I visit a shelter for women. And it's in an undisclosed location because these women are survivors of abuse and are pretty vulnerable.
And this is like a shelter for women who don't have any other place to stay.
That's correct. And you know, these are women who have been abandoned or disowned by their families. I spent a few hours speaking with them, and they had a lot of emotion, and they were expressing their concern and their worries about what the future holds for them. Let's hear from one of them. Her name is Amene. That's a 20-year-old who told me about what happened to her and why she was at this shelter.
تا وقتی جنگ طالب در داخل کشور افغانستان باشه هیچ وقت زنای افغانستان روی خوشبختی رو نمیبینه هیچ وقت.
You know, Marco, she's telling me as long as there's war and in this country, women of women in Afghanistan will never see peace and ease. And she told me that, you know, her husband had divorced her under pressure from his own family. She didn't want to get divorced. He didn't want to get divorced, but he was pressured to do so. And she told me that this shelter was her only hope.
Yeah, a really terrible situation, and hers is just one of many stories like that. And of course, we know that shortly after, the Taliban did in fact take control of Afghanistan. Do you know what happened to these women?
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to reach any of them. But what's important for me about this story, Marco, is that a lot of the coverage at the time was focused on what's happening on the battlefield, which provinces the Taliban had taken over and not or not. But here we got to hear from some of the most vulnerable people in the country whose lives were about to change. And, you know, I was able to access this space because I was a woman and I spoke the language. You know, Afghanistan is a very conservative society at the end of the day. And I think I've always seen this as our mission at the show, which is to tell stories that matter and, you know, connect. And we have to connect people who might be thousands of miles apart. And Marco, this is, to me, this work has never been more important than now. We see that journalism and the media in general is under attack in many parts of the world. And there's a lot of bad information out there on social media. And this is, it's in this kind of environment that we see that hatred and alienation grow. We can't let that happen. We have to continue to tell these stories and act as a bridge between these different communities.
Shirin, thank you for coming in and bringing these years of conflict into perspective.
My pleasure, Marco.
Well, as I said earlier, it is simply extraordinary the kinds of cataclysmic events that we've reported on over 30 years. Let me turn back to Neil Curry, the first executive producer of the show. I mean, you're no longer in the U.S., Neil, but in case you haven't heard, there's this America First thing happening now. In fairness, there are plenty of Americans who do care about the rest of the world, but I'm wondering what you think the role of a program like The World is today in the current environment.
Well, I would put it in a kind of phrase, a key phrase that I've been using quite a lot recently, working with journalists all over, local journalists all over Eastern Europe on disinformation and misinformation. I'd say it's to counter the echo chamber effect. The echo chamber being that tendency that we all have, whether it's driven by algorithms or our own personal preferences, to kind of surround ourselves with things that reinforce the views that we already have. I don't think that's a particularly healthy way of moving forwards, and it's become increasingly easy with social media. So I would like that phrase to be on the wall, guiding the program forward. You know, maybe the phrase echo chamber, just to remind us that that's, we are not the echo chamber. We are the broad view.
Neil, thank you so much for looking back with us.
My pleasure, Marco. And thank you so much for still being with the program 30 years on.
Neil Curry was the first executive producer of The World and is currently the director of the media consultancy Beyond Broadcasting.
"30 Years of Environment Coverage" is next. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Continuing our travels across 30 years of the show, Carolyn, I want to turn the mic over to you because a special focus for the show has always been the environment. And you've been taking us around the globe, reporting on the threats to our natural world, but also what makes it awe-inspiring.
Yeah, and that reporting started long before I joined the show, 10 years ago now. For many years, climate change has been the biggest environment story we've covered. And I was super curious to hear how we were talking about it way back in the day. So I dug into our archives to find the first time our show mentioned climate change or global warming. It was July of 1996.
Representatives from some 150 countries have begun a conference in Geneva on global warming. They're reviewing progress on the reduction in the emission of greenhouse gases, which contribute to the Earth's increasing temperature. The chairman of the conference, Chen Chimotengwende, says it's an urgent task.
We are having droughts, we are having floods, we are having so many other problems. There is a strong feeling and conviction that climate change has something to do with it.
That phrasing, there's a strong feeling and conviction that climate change has something to do with it, jumped out to me because it was right around this time that the global scientific consensus had finally solidified that climate change was happening and human activity was contributing to it.
And what I'm hearing there is that back in 1996, we were already reporting on a global UN conference to address climate change, which we, of course, continued to do and are still doing.
We sure are. That is another thing that struck me when I was looking at the archives. The world has been around to document basically the whole history of formalized global efforts to tackle climate change. Mm. We are 30 years old today, if you remember COP30, the 30th annual UN meeting to try to tackle climate change. That was just a couple of months ago, so we're the same age. Now, the most important of those meetings was in Paris in 2015. That's when every country in the world signed on to an agreement to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Je n'entends pas d'objection. L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
Right, and Carolyn, you were there. Your very first day working for the show was covering the UN Climate Summit in Paris.
It was, and what a place to start. There was so much optimism swirling about in that conference center. Results since then have been mixed. Greenhouse gas emissions are still rising, but there has been progress too.
Which we have also paid close attention to on the show.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
That is the little jingle we used to play before The Big Fix, a segment we launched back in 2019 and still have to focus on climate solutions.
Yeah, and renewable energy is one of those climate solutions that we focused on a lot. 30 years ago, it was just starting to develop.
It was such a little baby industry, Marco, which you can hear in one of our earliest stories about solar power from reporter Stephen Beard.
The solar equipment business is still almost a cottage industry in Britain.
That story featured the country's energy minister at the time, John Battle.
There's only two in Britain that have tried it. Two houses in Britain now. I ask you, why is it? Why are only two people interested?
Wait, only two houses in Great Britain with solar power? Was that serious or hyperbole?
I don't actually know, Marco, but either way, the story has changed so much regardless. Solar is often the cheapest option for new power. And as you told us just this year,
new research finds that for the first time ever, renewable sources of energy, primarily solar, now provide more electricity globally than coal.
We have also covered other good news on the environment beat, Marco. I know it might be hard to believe, but do you remember the hole in the ozone?
Very clearly. The pictures and explanations in Newsweek back in the day, not to mention the stories of sheep in Argentina that went blind from UV radiation seeping through the ozone hole. The link was never proven, but the ozone hole was real.
But there is a success story here because the world worked together to mostly stop using the chemicals that caused that hole in the ozone. And back in 2014, the UN announced that it was working. And that's something the world's former environment editor, Peter Thompson, reported on at the time.
The news is now ozone levels have finally stopped falling, and in some parts of the atmosphere, they've actually started increasing. This is a real global environmental success story. I think it's really important for folks to be reminded that when we really put our minds to things, we can fix a lot of the environmental problems that we've created for ourselves.
Yeah, the environment desk, not all gloom and doom.
Not all gloom and doom. But do you know what is really actually my very favorite thing about our environmental reporting?
I'm sure it's not getting seasick on your trip to Antarctica, which was otherwise a fantastic voyage. What is it?
I did not get seasick. Thank you for asking. our reporting, our environment reporting especially, really transports us somewhere. So, you know, reporters, we are able to go places where the environment is in trouble and figure out what the stakes are, what might help. So to celebrate our 30th anniversary, I grabbed a few clips that take us somewhere. Do you want to hear them, Marco?
You know I do.
Okay. Here is the first one.
Whoop! Did you hear it?
I heard it.
That totally did. We're moving away though.
Yeah.
We're gonna lose
Woo!
It. Oh, that was amazing. You can bounce your voice.
So speaking of that boat trip to Antarctica, this is tape from when I went to Thwaites Glacier back in 2019 on a ship with a bunch of scientists to study how fast that glacier was melting. And the sound you're hearing there is people bouncing their voices, echoing their voices off of the glacier face, which no one had ever gotten that close
wow.
to before.
That's amazing. For a second, I thought it might have been an animal that you were waiting to see surface from the water. But no, just human voice bouncing.
Yeah,
amazing.
And taking our listeners to a place really no one had ever been before. So that was a pretty special moment on our show. I've got another one, and you're going to have to listen like really closely to this one, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Do you have any
Something
idea what this is?
Exhaling? Is it the sound of water or air coming out of a whale's blowhole?
It is something exhaling, and it is also the sound of a very long tongue poking into an ant mound to slurp
oh my gosh.
Up those ants.
I'm remembering the story now. Tell us more.
So this is the sound of an anteater eating its lunch. I recorded it at a veterinary clinic in Brazil where the anteater was being treated for burn wounds it got during a record-setting fire season last year. So I got to be up close and personal with that guy while he was eating his lunch.
That's incredible.
Okay, so I have one more for you. I think it might be my favorite. I did not record it. Let's play out the whole clip. So this is from
wow.
a story on one of our early shows way before my time here. It is people, the Byaka people in the Congo River Basin, singing in harmony with the crickets, cicadas, frogs, and birds while they are out in the rainforest. And the story at the time said they were treating the jungle as a vast auditorium.
That is incredible.
Yeah, and I really like that one because the voices mixing with the animal sounds into one melody. It illustrates something we try to do on the show a lot, which is show that humans are not separate from nature. We are part of it.
The World's Carolyn Beeler, current co-host, with her mind very much still on the environment beat. Thank you very much for this.
You are so welcome, Marco.
Stay tuned. We're about to take a deep dive into music and something you might remember, the global hit. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we are celebrating the new year and 30 years of The World. This show, that is, not the whole planet, of course. One way we've transported you to many different parts of the planet over the years is through music.
Yep, from day one, just dropping into a country and checking out what they're listening to.
Today's global hit, which we're listening to now, is a blend of jazz fusion, Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter, and Brazilian percussion, Olodum, on a release entitled Ritual Beating System.
Our former host, Tony Khan, there, introducing our very first global hit on our very first show. Marco, that segment was your brainchild, right?
Yep, I plead guilty. The idea was pretty simple, like FM radio, no repeats. We'd hear from a different artist around the globe each day, typically our sign-off at the end of each hour. It has really been a journey of discovery, not just for our listeners, but also for me, a real treat.
You have done a ton of interviews with musicians over the years. If you had to pick just one favorite, I know it would be hard, but what would it be?
Oh, Carolyn, that's a tough one. You know, I'll never forget meeting guitarist Ali Farka Touré at his home in Mali. But I'm going to go with this really fun interview I had with Marianne Faithfull, who died less than a year ago. Of course, an iconic figure in rock as well as folk music. And when I met her, she had just come out with an album of cover songs called Easy Come, Easy Go.
And I'm guessing you have some of that ready for us to listen to?
I totally do. This was 2008, and the show had been doing an occasional feature asking artists what was on their iPod.
Oh my gosh, I haven't thought of an iPod in so long, Marco.
So Marianne Faithfull told me she'd been listening to a lot of jazz, Duke Ellington's In My Solitude, for example, which she covered on the album.
With cologne everywhere, I sit and I stare. I know that I'll soon go mad. I love all the early jazz, the New Orleans jazz. I love Jelly Roll Morton. And I love Miles Davis and Charlie Parker. Coltrane best, I think. My favorite things. I love that whole record. My favorite things is just a wonderful soundtrack to lots and lots of different parts of my life. It's so cool. I guess I really like it as a refuge from very emotional stuff. I mean, it is emotional but different.
Now spin back very slightly on Marianne Faithfull's iPod from Coltrane to Claudio Monteverdi and one of the world's earliest operas, L'Orfeo.
I always love Orfeo, which is the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. It's a very, very potent story for any musician. And I love it, and I play it a lot. It's highly dramatic and very beautiful musically. It's a life story of many, many musicians, where they nearly get to life and then they fall back again.
Drop a Letter Down to B for Blur. Marianne Faithfull doesn't cover any tunes by the band's frontman, Damon Albarn, on her new album, but they do have a close musical collaboration.
I really like Blur, and I really like Tender.
You've worked quite a bit with Damon Albarn over the years, haven't you?
Yes, I have, and I like him very much, and he's been very generous to me by letting me use these great songs. Yeah. Lots of love, Damon. Yeah.
Tender is the night, lying by your side. Tender is the touch.
The song Tender by Blur, in an interview from 2008 with the late Marianne Faithfull, whose voice, even just speaking, Marco, is quite mesmerizing.
I know, isn't it?
So you were asking that question, what is on your iPod, not just to artists like her, but also to our listeners, right?
That's right. Starting the following year in 2009, we got all kinds of answers from listeners. We played them on our show. One of our producers at the time, Clark Boyd, went through the first few weeks of our musical mailbag, and this is what he found.
I happen to be into Spanish music.
So you picked up on the Spanish thread.
Yeah, and I'm talking not just Spanish language. I'm talking groups from Spain. And I want to start with one that was suggested by listener Michael Gardner. He wrote in and pointed out that he's been listening to this group called Jarabe de Palo, which is a Spanish rock group. They had a big hit back in 1996 with this track called La Flaca, which is about sort of a one-night love affair that one of the band members had in Cuba. So let's hear the original, La Flaca.
En la vida conocí mujer igual a la flaca, coral negro de La Habana, tremendísima mulata, 100 libras de piel y hueso, 40 kilos de salsa, y en la cara dos soles que sin palabras hablan.
This is really cool.
Yeah, no, it's excellent music, and you can see why it was such a big hit at the time. So when I looked into it, I had not heard of Jarabe de Palo before. So I went and I looked it up, and they've actually got their new album out just this year. Is called Orquesta Reciclando. So
Recycled Orchestra?
Yeah, or Revisited Orchestra. Yeah. So what they've done is they've gone back to all their hits, like La Flaca, and put this really like Cuban Latin dance hall jazz vibe on it. So this is what the new version of La Flaca sounds like.
La vida conocí mujer igual a la flaca coral negro de La Habana tremendísima mulata y libras de piel y hueso 40 kilos de salsa y en la cara dos soles que sin palabras hablan.
So Jarabe de Palo, what else do you have, Clark?
Well, Matthew Germanson wrote in and he pointed out this really band that I had never heard of before. They're actually not playing anymore. They've broken up. But it's this group called O Funkillo from Sevilla, from Seville.
Right.
In
spelled
Spain.
O apostrophe funk apostrophe I-L-L-O.
Yeah, and I kind of have it on somewhat good authority that this is the name itself is this kind of mashup between this Sevillana phrase that means sort of like, hey, dude, with funk thrown in the middle.
Right.
And you can definitely get the funky vibe off of these guys. Listen to this track. It's called Fiesta Siesta. Fiesta, fiesta, fiesta. No más queremos fiesta, fiesta, fiesta. Y no miremos siesta, siesta, siesta.
Va a seguir la fiesta, fiesta, fiesta. They've got the funky guitar down pat.
Absolutely. I'm sure there are a lot of Spaniards out there that are fairly upset that that kind of party band's not around anymore.
Yeah, I'll bet. O Funkillo from Seville there. A track called Fiesta Siesta. So, Clark, I have to ask you, what's on your iPod that you want to share? Anything?
Well, yeah, in keeping with the theme here with some Spanish music, and I can't tell kind of why I clocked in on this. Maybe it's the cold weather that's descended on us here in Boston, or just the fact that, you know, I love Spain so much, and they can do so much with pork products. But one of the bands that I really love is another band from the south of Spain. This band is called Los Delincuentes, the Delinquents. They are from Jerez de la Frontera, and they famous.
That would be Sherrytown. For
that would be
everybody out there.
That's right. And they're very proud of their southern Spain heritage. Right? They once famously remarked in a song that. Yeah, sure, it's weird that my girlfriend is an alien from outer space, but I'm from Jerez, so it doesn't matter. I'm actually crazier than she is. But they have a new album out as well, and they do kind of also a flamenco fusion. They're not afraid to throw in blues riffs and rock riffs, and the new album even has a little bit of a reggae feel on it to a couple of songs. But I wanted to play this one, this track called Cicatrizando, which means scarring. And you might actually detect a slight country western vibe going on in the background of this one. So here we go.
¿Eres tú? El que pone rumbo fijo al sur. El viajero que siempre busca la luz.
Marco there talking music with former show producer Clark Boyd back in 2009.
So, Carolyn, you're going to be back in a few with a look at another big feature of our show. I'm going to keep you all in suspense.
Get excited, everyone.
I got to say, though, it has been such a blast featuring these various approaches to hearing music from around the world and sharing them with you out in Radioland. Also, for several years in a row, some of you enjoyed the sounds live. I produced a showcase at South by Southwest called All Music is World Music. And one of our first featured performers was a global artist who grew up in the U.S., Macleet Hadero.
Sole, sole, so, so, sole, so, so, sole, so, lay. I've been dreaming, dreaming of the sun, of this lovely, lovely melody. Holy queen of sunshine, shine down on me.
Sole, sole from her first album, On a Day Like This. Macleet actually boomeranged back to the show in 2020 to tell other stories like hers in a continuing series called Movement, stories about music and migration. Macleet, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Macleet, I'm going to go back to when we started our show, The World, back in 1996, a time when there were record stores with sections labeled world music. But that terminology, world music, changed at some point. As someone who sat in this category for some time, how do you feel about the term world music, then or now?
You know, it definitely has gotten under my skin over the years. In many ways, because it has this sense of being a kind of, you know, quote unquote, everything but category. It's like there's Western classical music, there's Western pop, and then everything else falls under that term. And it's flattening, and it just doesn't work. You know, that's not what humanity is. That's not what humanity's like. And it's limiting.
Yeah, and it's kind of defunct at this point. So I do want to hear more about music over the past couple of decades that has shaped you and who you are as a musician, McLeod, and that somehow speaks to this whole idea of global music.
Just to say, he's not from the last few decades, but I do want to mention Mulatu Astatke, the godfather of Ethiopian jazz. And, you know, a lot of the music that he was making in Addis Ababa happened in the late 60s and early 70s, but it's only in the last couple of decades that he rose to global stardom. For me, Ethio Jazz, the music that Mulatu Astatke founded and began, is really tells a circular story. You know, it's based in American jazz and African music, Ethiopian music, the pentatonic scales of the highlands of Ethiopia, and how those musics speak in relation to each other. So you can, like some people might call it world music, but in a sense, it's music that would never have happened without America. And so it's just one of those places where hyphenation is really a better strategy.
That's Mulatu Astatke playing a new version of his tune Netsenet. It's off his 2025 album, Mulatu Plays Mulatu.
So, Marco, what about you? I mean, I know it's hard to pick just one, but is there a musician from the past 30 years that you tend to go back to?
If you know me, you know I've been a fan of Fela Kuti in Nigeria since I lived in West Africa, but I never got to meet him or see him live before he died in 1997. I did meet both of his musical sons, Femi and Sheyun, and I actually went to Lagos to do a story about Sheyun. I keep coming back to Sheyun's first big self-titled release because for me it represents several things. It represents generational change. He's still carrying the tradition of his father, even leading his father's band, the Egypt 80, where a Fela track might cover side A and B of a single LP, Sheyun delivers the same punch, just more tightly.
When you turn television and you listen to the radio, you could see the things them do, you could hear the things them say, you could see the things them do, you could hear the things them say, you could see the corruption.
So both Sheyun Kuti and Mulatu Astatke, whom you mentioned, McLeod, have been around a while. In fact, when I first heard your music, I'd been listening to the Ethiopique series of albums and heard some of that old 60s vibe in your music. But as we listen to the present, I'm curious what recent artists have grabbed your attention. Like, who have you been digging into in recent years?
There are so many artists who just do this for me every day. One artist is Benjamin Clementine, who is currently based in London with Ghanaian roots. He has this kind of spare production and beautiful crooner voice. Other folks who I'm loving these days are Little Sims and Obongjiar. They both have Nigerian roots and also are based in London. Let's play an excerpt of the song Point and Kill, which is by Little Sims and features Obongjiar, and it was released in 2021.
Family no go so far, oh, in my lifetime. They be fine doing proper, no lie, lie. Give me strength, let me prosper. Daddy say you want me to be lawyer, be doctor, riff raff, kitty con, window shopper. Oh, yeah, fine boy, take away auntie, bougie, akile, oh, I fancy when I see a type.
Point and kill, if I born it, it's mine. You can't stop me, hey.
Little Sims featuring Obongjiar, recommended by MacLeet. MacLeet, there's an arc to our relationship. You came to us with a CD of music some years ago. You were then featured on our show as an artist. And then I featured you at South by Southwest. But do you remember when you first became aware of our show?
I think the first time that I really started listening to the world was in the months before I first appeared on it. And I'll tell you, I was actually really nervous the first time we did an interview. And it's amazing to think that our relationship and this arc has evolved over now decades. And then what was interesting to me is after that first interview, I started like seeing you at these different world music events. And I was like, wow, here's this news person in these global music spaces. And it really made the connection between music and the social context that it sits within and often reflects just such a seamless clarity. I really understood the world from the way that you approached music and lived within those musical spaces.
Yeah, you have to be in those spaces if you want to get it. Well, MacLeet, let's come full circle. You've got a new album out. Tell us about it.
So the album is called A Piece of Infinity, and this is my record that really interprets traditional songs from across Ethiopia. And it also has some originals that I wrote. And today I thought the perfect song to play would be the song Abba by Yehosh, because it is New Year's, and Abba by Yehosh is this celebratory Ethiopian New Year's song. And I thought, you know what? This is the day to ring it out.
Perfect selection. A happy New Year song selected for us by MacLeet Hedera. MacLeet, it has been so special to have you with us today. Thank you so much for being part of our 30th birthday celebration of the world, MacLeet.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
Coming into the home stretch of the world's 30th birthday show, what better way to wrap things up than with our favorite game, the Geo Quiz? For the first roughly half of our show's history, it sounded something like this.
We want you to name a city where traffic can be so slow that commuting becomes painful. We're headed to Australia, to that country's two southernmost states, and you get to name them. For our geo quiz, we ask you what Kitanago is and where it's headed. Today's geo quiz might give you bad breath. Can you tell us where most of the world's supply of garlic comes from right now? Name a city where you can find a Mayan stone supposedly predicting the end of the world. Oh, and with a swim-up bar nearby.
Playing this daily trivia game was one way of getting to know you, our listeners, better.
Yeah, that's right, Caroline. And I spoke with Neil Curry, our first executive producer, about that. Early on, Neil, you were very much focused on listener engagement. And one of the ways you thought about that was establishing some way of connecting Americans to the rest of the world, the geography of the world, almost as a quiz. Talk about that.
I love trivia. And I just think that so many people love trivia that it was almost like an obvious thing to do. And I'm delighted that you've actually brought it back in video version on YouTube. And I do challenge myself with it from time to time. So the idea was to just throw out there, you know, some clues as to what location we were trying to find.
And no small bit of inspiration, the Car Talk guys, Tom and Ray Maliazzi, had their own quizzes. And you were really tickled by that.
Oh, those guys or blokes, as we call them over here, I just thought they were inspirational.
The Geo Quiz was inspired by Car Talk. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's right. Neil also mentioned that we recently brought back the Geo Quiz, this time on our YouTube channel, which has been a ton of fun and surprisingly hard at times.
Marco and I play against each other, and now we want to give you a chance to get in on the game. Here is how it's going to work.
So you're going to hear an excerpt from one of the geo quizzes Carolyn and I played on YouTube recently. We got clues about one country and had to guess which country it was.
Marco and I each wrote down a guess after each clue. You can do the same right now if you want.
You'll be hearing five clues, my friends, before we reveal the answer. So listen up. Here we go.
Starting off strong with sports, this country has historically performed quite well in the Olympics. It is in the top 10 of nations with the most medals. However, it has missed a few games over the years.
And throughout history, athletes from this country have appeared under five different three-letter designations by the International Olympic Committee. Okay.
I've got a guess.
Yeah, me too.
Five different. I don't know. I have no idea if that's right. I'm thinking one of recent history, one of more farther back history. Could be.
Yeah.
All right. This country also has some interesting laws. Dancing is banned on certain holidays, and breaking the rule can land you a fine.
This is interesting because although the origin of this law is religious, this country does not have an official established religion.
I'm feeling strengthened in my first guess.
Well, I'm glad you feel strengthened because I don't feel strengthened. Wow. Well, I'm definitely more stumped than the last episode we did.
I feel like I want to give you my own hints, but I don't know if I'm right.
If I'm stumped at 10, I'm going to ask you for your your extra credit hint.
I'll give you my extra credit hints, but we'll see if I'm even right. Okay. The soft drink Fanta is produced by Coca-Cola, but it was invented in this country. Ooh. At first, it wasn't made of oranges. Instead, the ingredients included leftover apple fibers, mash from cider presses, and whey, a cheese byproduct. Fanta used to have whey in it.
Fascinating. Wow.
Okay, I had no idea this had any association with the country I think it might be, so.
At the time, this country had a hard time getting the right ingredients for regular Coke. Coca-Cola still wanted to maintain its popularity in this country, even though access to ingredients was scarce, so they came up with this makeshift recipe.
That is fascinating.
That is fascinating, and who knew Fanta was invented here, but I'm still stumped as to what here is.
I'm sticking with my original guess.
Fanta.
Clue number four. Speaking of drinks, in the last 10 years, consumption of non-alcoholic beer in this country has doubled to nearly 10% of its total domestic beer market. It boasts the highest non-alcoholic beer consumption in the world.
Part two of that clue, number four. In fact, as the top recycling country in the world, this country's outdoor bars serve drinks in reusable bottles and glasses to prevent stolen dishes. Servers collect a deposit that customers can get back later. I found this clue very helpful.
Yeah?
Let me just say that right now.
Really? Are you kidding?
No, I'm real.
I'm sticking with my same choice. Did you change yours?
I did.
Okay. We've done drinks, now onto food. This country loves a type of street food originally brought there by immigrants. Last year, the nation where this dish originated tried to regulate what can legally use the name of this specialty. The country we were looking for fought back, defended its take on the dish, and said that regulation would make it too expensive.
Feeling good about...
You're feeling good?
My guess number four now.
Me too. Me too. Okay. Extra credit. What street food are we talking about?
Oh.
Don't say it. Just write it down.
Big fan, just saying.
Okay, those were five clues about the same country from our YouTube geo quiz. Are you ready for the answer?
It is
Germany.
Yeah. How did you do at home? You can go to our YouTube channel and let us know in the comments. We are at The World News GBH, all one word, The World News GBH.
Thank you for playing along, and thank you for listening to The World, whether you've been doing it for years or just a couple of days.
Today's show was produced by Kate Ellis and April Peavy. It was engineered and mixed by Mike Wilkins, Uzair Ahmed, and Michaela Varela. Special thanks to our intern, Maria Valdez, and GBH Archives manager, Peter Higgins.
Each day, the interviews you hear on our show are produced by Joy Hackle, Joshua Coe, and Hannah Shinatry. Our reporters include Tibisa Isaiah, Jerry Haddon, Orla Berry, Bianca Hillier, Shirin Jafari, and Jeremy Siegel.
Sara Hassan and Lex Weaver make up our digital team. Our show is edited by Aaron Schachter, Gina Kaufman, and Matthew Bell, and is directed by Jenna Gadbois.
Our supervising producer is Patty Daniels. Our executive editor, Tinku Ray. And my boss and the man in the corner office is executive producer Dan Lothian.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a very happy new year, and we'll be back tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.